Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon and welcome to another program in the Commonwealth Club's 2008 Presidential Candidates Conversation Series. Today's program, co-organized by the Mexican Heritage Plaza in association with ABC 7 Television, KGO News Talk Radio, AM 810, and the Bay Area News Group. I'm Steve Wright, and I'm the editorial page editor and vice president at the San Jose Mercury News. Today's program features Bill Richardson, governor of New Mexico and 2008 Democratic presidential candidate. As with all presidential candidates appearing before the Commonwealth Club, we have asked Governor Richardson to engage in a wide-ranging conversation rather than giving a traditional speech. This should allow us to cover the greatest number of issues of interest to the American public. Let me give you some brief background on Governor Richardson. His credentials include 14 years as U.S. Congressman from New Mexico, as well as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and U.S. Secretary of Energy under Bill Clinton. Bill Richardson was born in Pasadena, California, and grew up in Mexico City and later Massachusetts. He graduated from Tufts University and Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Governor Richardson is now in his second term as governor of New Mexico, where he has championed efforts to make the state known as the clean energy state by focusing on renewable resources and reducing carbon emissions. For his human rights work and international diplomacy efforts in North Korea, Iraq, and China, Governor Richardson has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize four times. Today, Governor Richardson will be in conversation with Fernando Zazueta. He's a prominent Silicon Valley attorney and founding member of the Commonwealth Club's Silicon Valley Advisory Council. Fernando Zazueta holds a law degree from the University of California, Davis. He is also the founding board chairman of the Mexican Heritage Corporation and is fluent in Spanish and English. Mr. Zazueta is also a member of the San Jose Mercury News Hispanic Advisory Committee. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Governor Bill Richardson and Fernando Zazueta.
Thank you, Steve. As a reminder to our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Bill Richardson, governor of New Mexico and the 2008 Democratic presidential candidate, one of several. Thank you for being with us today, Governor Richardson. As your moderator, I'll cover a set of topics which the Commonwealth Club will discuss with all presidential candidates who come before us. We're going to look ahead today, exploring who Bill Richardson is and what he would do as president rather than just talking about today's news. We'll start with a conversation between us, and then following a Commonwealth Club tradition, I'll intersperse questions submitted by our audience here in San Jose. Although some of the questions may overlap these groupings, in order to help the flow of our conversation, I've divided the questions into the following three groups. First, who is Bill Richardson as a person before he came onto the public stage? Second, as president, how would he deal with the daunting array of domestic challenges facing our country? And third, how would he shape America's foreign policy in this increasingly complex and troubled world? I said this to the governor earlier, but I'll say it again. We have a lot of issues to discuss, so please make your responses brief and to the point of the question. First, let's start with you as a private person before you became a public figure. The name Richardson doesn't immediately suggest an Hispanic background, and a lot of people are just beginning to learn about you and your campaign for president. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what or who shaped you, and what were you doing before you came onto the national scene?
Bueno, primero voy a hablarles en español. Now, thank you. Thank you. You know, I have to do that because the name Richardson is not Hispanic. And I am trying to obviously, not run as a Hispanic candidate, but as a governor very proud to be Hispanic. Who is Bill Richardson? I'm a regular person like you. I'm not a candidate with a lot of advisors. I'm not a candidate that goes by polls. I'm a little rough on the edges. I've been in public life literally all my life. I was raised in Mexico by a mother who only spoke Spanish to me. I was my father, when he spoke to me, spoke to me in English. Totally bicultural background. I feel very strongly that my bicultural roots have enabled me to participate in politics and diplomacy, in negotiating. I believe the essence of governing is diplomacy. It's talking. It's dialogue. It's mediation. It's not first seeking a military solution. I believe that I can bring this country together because of my background. All my life I've worked to do that. Republicans and Democrats, nations. I brought hostages home from foreign lands. What you see is basically somebody that I believe is committed to making this nation a little better. Who else am I? I'm like you. I love sports. I love music. I love the Eagles. I love Dionne Warwick, who sang the song about San Jose. You're all too young to know that. But I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm very pleased that all of you have shown up, although I can't see you. I can't see anybody here.
Did you love that San Jose State beat New Mexico in the football bowl?
I was at that game, and you have a formidable team. I met your president, Les Francis. Obviously, San Jose. I've been here many times. I like this community. I like Silicon Valley. I like the fact that Silicon Valley represents technology, economic growth. I love this state because you set positive trends. You've had great positive results in making a better climate for not just yourselves, but the country, global climate change. And you're the seventh largest economy in the world. And the only message here with respect to San Jose State and California is now California is important in the presidential selection process. In the past, you only were important to candidates because they came here to raise money, pick your pockets, and now you have a major stake because February 5th, you will be the second wave of primaries, and California issues such as agriculture and water and protecting the environment and transportation and immigration now rise to the fore.
Thank you. Our second broad group of questions deals with domestic policy issues. And as you know, we have a record $8.8 trillion deficit in our budget. So please frame your responses with this deficit in mind. Dealing first of all with health, one of the biggest challenges we face as a nation is that we have over almost 50 million Americans who don't have health insurance. Is this a problem you think you can fix?
Yes. I'm optimistic about resolving problems. I'm not a naysayer. I'm positive about this country. I believe bringing people together, negotiating, working with both sides of the aisle, we can get this done. I've done this in New Mexico. What would I do about a national health care plan? Number one, I believe that it's a right. I believe every American should have health care. Number two, I believe also that we've got to do it right. And I am not a Democrat that says we got to tax you to do it or to spend more. Our system today on health care, we spend $2.2 trillion on a health care budget. Yet today, 47 million Americans are uninsured. And what is needed, in my judgment, is a plan that covers everybody that has the following principles. One, if you have a health care plan, any of you, and you're satisfied with it, you can keep it. Two, and this is fundamental, everybody should share in a health care plan. Everybody should contribute a little bit, the worker, the business, the state, and the federal government. We should be a lot more efficient than we are. Number three, in this nation, I think we need to emphasize prevention. I got rid of junk food in schools in my state. We need to do that nationally. We should have healthy breakfasts. We should have a mandatory phys ed. We should give incentives to companies to make sure that their employees have healthier lifestyles, workout. Medicare, 33% of it is diabetes, yet there's no prevention efforts. I would take other steps, too, to make sure our healthcare system includes everybody, because it's a problem of cost and coverage. Number one, the states. We should handle Medicaid, children, SCHIP programs, programs that deal with working families, the federal government, Medicare, seniors, the disabled. There's such a conglomeration of bureaucracy. $2.2 trillion budget, 31%, goes to administration, goes to red tape, does not go to direct care. What we need is electronic records to make it better. Any veteran that is here, what I would say, an enlisted person, you have to go today as a veteran to the nearest VA hospital. Hopefully there's one nearby here. What I would do is make it more efficient. I would give that veteran a hero's health card, and that veteran could go anywhere with any doctor, with any hospital to get that health care. And then, now, Fernando, this is a really complicated question, so you said be brief, but I'm almost finished. What I would also do is give a refundable tax credit to any small business, to any individual that needs that health care. That would be a check up front to help. I'd put a limit on credit cards in the interest rate for those that pay their health care through credit cards for catastrophic. I'd eliminate the pre-existing condition requirement. I would make sure also that we find a way to, as I mentioned, fund better the National Cancer Institute, stem cell research, biomedical research. And this is, I believe, a community in Silicon Valley where you specialize in that kind of economic growth. I believe the Democratic Party should be a party of entrepreneurship, innovation, economic growth, space. We've forgotten about that. You're looking at a Democrat, too, that has cut taxes, personal income tax, state personal income tax, capital gains, to bring renewable energy companies to my state, to bring movies to my state, some from you guys, but that's okay. But also that we should find ways to grow the economy so that the middle class, which has been excluded from economic growth in this country, high health care costs, pensions, ways that wages don't stay high, can be included in a globalized world that is not providing for that middle class. You asked also about the deficit. Can I answer that? Because, you know, any politician that doesn't tell you that we got a deficit, $8.8 trillion, and we'll do nothing for it. Here's what I would do about the deficit. One, the $450 billion that we spent in Iraq, boom, oops, to domestic needs to reduce the deficit. Number two, I'm a governor. I have to balance budgets. I've balanced five. You know, you almost may get impeached if you don't do that as a governor. I'd have a constitutional amendment to balance the budget. I would have line item veto. I would have pay-as-you-go policies. Basically, if you're going to have a new program or you're going to cut taxes, find a way to pay for it. I'd get rid of corporate welfare, $71 billion. Now, this is not going to make me popular with your delegation. I'd get rid of congressional earmarks because there's waste, there's pork. And then lastly, I would reorder priorities. I'm somebody that believes that human needs, healthcare, education should be the priorities of a nation that needs to invest in its people.
We're facing some cuts here in the mental health field for the county of Santa Clara, and that seems to be the area that gets cut first out whenever there's a shortfall of funds. Would your health plan that you envision cover those mental health issues as well as the physical health issues?
Yes, Fernando. In New Mexico, when I became governor, we had mental health handled in about 16 departments. Turf issues. When I was in the Congress, too, mental health, and it still doesn't have what is called parity with other illnesses. I would change that. One out of four Americans, if you include depression, has a mental health problem. Children, kids, today, autism among kids is rampant. And it is a problem of not just learning disability, but it's a mental health problem. What would I do? In New Mexico, we brought all of mental health, we're the only state that has done it, into what is called a collaborative, into one agency. But as a president, I would give mental health a parity that cancer and other illnesses have. It's going to cost more. But I believe in terms of coverage, of insurance, of treatment. You know, we got huge problems with meth. We got huge problems with PTSD with our veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And we don't know how to treat it. You know, I get a lot of my people in New Mexico, they say, give me more money for it. That'll help. I said, no, what kind of treatment? I think we need to find ways that we consolidate mental health and give it the priority it deserves in our medical system.
One of our nation's most contentious issues is immigration, and we've all seen the TV coverage of desperate people risking and sometimes losing their lives to enter this country without waiting for formal permission. How does your Hispanic heritage help you deal with this issue of an estimated 12 million folks who are in the United States today but don't have the documentation to be here legally, and should they be given a path to citizenship ultimately? Should they be sent back to their home countries, or do you have some other alternative?
Well, my vision is that we're a just, we're a good country. We should do what's right. We're a nation of immigrants, but we should also do what's practical. And what's happening today in the Congress is a dysfunctional relationship between a Congress and a president, where last week negotiations that were moving in the right direction just collapsed. Not enough Republican votes, not enough Democratic push. We've got to do better, and I believe we have to fix this problem, not because it's economic issues, but it involves the soul of our country. A lot of ugly things are being said. You know, you hear those talk show radio people and others on TV inflaming what are called the politics of fear. This is what I would do. I would basically take five steps, and I'll be quick. One, we have to secure the border. More Border Patrol agents, no question about it. More technology. But I'm not going to be somebody that says we should build a wall. That's not America. A wall between two countries. And you know, Fernando, you and I are old enough to know that, remember Ronald Reagan? You know, I didn't vote with him much when I was in Congress, but I liked one thing he said. He went to the Berlin Wall. He had a conference with Gorbachev, and he said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. You know, I was proud of our country. Now, what else do we do? Number two, those that knowingly hire illegal workers should be punished. That law should be enforced. We don't do that. Number three, how about foreign policy? How about being frank with our friends in Mexico? I know President Calderon. We're countries that are close. How about saying to Mexico, hey, Mexico, instead of having those summits, you know, the presidents get together with a big flag. Well, you don't have a flag here. With the flags, and they say nothing. They say, you know, we're going to reduce immigration. Then nothing happens. You say to Mexico, do a little more to help your own people. Give them some jobs. But at the very least, you know, maybe we can work together to have some joint border projects. But at the very least, stop giving some of your people maps in the most porous areas in the border. At least do that. So that's another element. Another one is one that is, I think, important here to Silicon Valley. Raise illegal immigration quotas. Raise them for jobs that we need, H-1B visas, in many sectors where we need that competitiveness. The problem there is backlog. It's bureaucracy. It's red tape. It's not enough staff. It's so many regulations that a lot of good people can't come in. And then lastly, a legalization plan. What's the alternative? The alternative is going to be we got to deport 12 million people? Who's going to find them? Where are they? Who's going to bear the cost of this? And that's not America. So what you do, and this is controversial, you set up an earn legalization program. And this is what happens. You must follow the following conditions if you want to stay. And it's not amnesty. It's not automatic citizenship. Here is what the conditions that are kind of in there, but I think should stay. One, you got to learn English. Two, you got to pass a background check and obey the laws. Three, you got to pay back taxes. You got to pay fines for coming here illegally. You've got to also what's 45? Oh, I got to finish? Oh, okay, because I wondered, 45? Oh, okay. Oh, you're telling him. Okay. Finally, what I would do is have this legalization process. But, you know, there's some problems with the bill. One, it divides families. We shouldn't have an immigration law that divides families. Two, the guest worker provision doesn't have labor protections. You know, you're going to bring guest workers, agricultural workers. For God's sakes, give them health care. Give them a right to unionize. Give them a chance to, like, have some protections. And then the wall's a problem. But I believe all of these issues are resolvable. I am a little hopeful that the Congress is going to go back and maybe for the first time do something in a bipartisan way in years. Now, I do believe that this is an issue that we should not look at political gain. Do what's right. It's not pleasant. You're not going to get any votes out of immigration. You know, the Hispanic vote, they're going to see who has done something to make it right.
Well, certainly the environment has become a hot topic. What did you learn as Secretary of Energy under President Clinton that you would implement as president in your first term?
Well, what I learned is that we've never had an energy policy in this country. What I learned that we tried in the Clinton administration, we did a little bit. Both parties have been derelict in dealing with the enormous problems we have, high gasoline prices, the fact that 65% of our oil is imported and it's countries like Iran and OPEC that are unfriendly, the fact that we don't have energy efficiency in this country. This is what I would do as president. I noticed that the Congress is going to pass an energy bill. They're going to try to come up with something. I think that's meaningless. I don't think it's going to mean anything. What I would do as president is I would do the following. I'd ask every one of you here to sacrifice a little bit. This is what I would do. And that's not going to be a popular word. With my consultants have told me, don't use that word. People don't. They think of Jimmy Carter. I believe we all, I remember John F. Kennedy. He said two things that are very important. One, he said we're going to go to the moon in 10 years. He thought big. The second thing he said, we want somebody that can inspire the American people to do something for the collective good. And I think the American people are ready. What would I do? An Apollo program, a Manhattan program that would reduce that dependence from 65 to 10% by a massive shift. Fossil fuels to renewable technologies, solar, wind, biomass, fuel cells, distributed generations, ethanol, biofuels. I would say to Detroit, by 2020, you have to have vehicles at 50 miles per gallon. 50. I would also say that we got to develop the plug-in hybrid, 100 miles per gallon. We can do that. We have the technology. And what I would say to everyone here is, this is not going to be a mandate, but in your daily life, with appliances, with mass transit, with air conditioning, with heating, with lighting, just be a little more energy efficient. In fact, if you come into work here by vehicle in a month, one day come in by mass transit. And this is another issue. Here in California, I've been all over the state. I have come to a conclusion. You have a traffic problem in this state. But, you know, we've never had a president, and a president should say to the San Jose's, to the Los Angeles, hey, you know, let's think about smart growth and open space and the way we live in the future. As a president, my annual pork highway bill is going to shift, and we're going to find ways to work with states and local communities to deal with mass transit, energy efficient, light rail. I did that in New Mexico, Albuquerque and Santa Fe. It's very popular now, and we only have 2 million people. And people can't, you can't keep people off the train. I can't get on it. Well, I can't. But I believe we have to look and not be afraid of the future.
Thank you. Here's a question from our audience. I'll paraphrase it because it's rather lengthy. Would you be willing to undertake a Manhattan-type project to reduce our country's dependence on foreign oil?
Yes, yes, I would. Let me just add a little bit to what I said. Greenhouse gas emissions. You know, if you look, I'm going to take a little bow here. The League of Conservation Voters, the Sierra Club, said Richardson's plan is the most aggressive. This is how I would do it. Reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, which scientists have said is man-made pollution, and it's caused by fossil fuels. President Bush finally has sort of accepted this, although his solution is to have more meetings. My solution would be to have mandates. You know, I was very proud in my state. President Bush got out of the Kyoto Treaty. I said, well, New Mexico, we're going to abide by the Kyoto Treaty. And we did. We've done so far. What we need to do is set some very tough, what is called a cap-and-trade system. A cap-and-trade. In other words, you have to reduce pollution by the following. I believe by 2020, 30% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. And by 2040, 90%. That's kind of along the lines that Al Gore has proposed, which I believe makes sense. I just hope Al doesn't get in the race. But it's got to be, you know, it's got to be a cap and trade system. And people say to me, well, why don't you do a carbon tax? Well, I don't believe a carbon tax makes sense because that goes to the consumer. That's passed on to a middle class that is the same with a gasoline tax. I think it's what we need is massive public and private investment. But a cap and trade system mandates you have got to reduce by a certain amount or there will be fines and you will lose federal funding. That's what we need to do. But this is international. This requires diplomacy. The U.S. has to lead. 25% of the world's pollution is caused by us, yet we're just 5% of the world's population. That means talking to China and India. That means talking to the third world. That means saying to the European Union, this woman, Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, you're right. We'll join you. We'll lead. But instead we say, no, we're going to have a meeting, and at the end of 2008, maybe we can have some goals. We don't need goals anymore. We need targets. This is national security. This is a moral imperative. And you know who's going to lead this effort of the Apollo Manhattan Project? Kids, young people, through technology, the Internet. They're the most sensitive to protecting our planet. I believe it's a matter of national security, and you here in California have the most at stake with the beautiful waters and landscape, and you need to have a little more open space, though.
Just for the purposes of our audience, you mentioned the Kyoto Accords or the Kyoto Protocol. Perhaps you can tell us what that was and why we rejected it.
Well, we rejected it. The president rejected it, basically said the science did not justify having those reductions, which I believe were pretty modest. I believe it was greenhouse gas emission reductions by, I think it was 30% by 2050. Very modest at the time. That's been overtaken by events. I believe that I've said, as president, my second day in office, because the first day I'd get us out of Iraq. The second day... The second day, I'd announce a global greenhouse gas emissions plan that would basically replace the Kyoto Treaty. We've lost 6 years. We got to have a new one that starts, I believe, with the year 2008.
Nuclear energy is used elsewhere in the world, and I haven't heard that the problem of disposing of radioactive waste has been solved, but nuclear power seems to be back in the news as a possible source of energy for this country. How do you feel about that?
Nuclear power should be part of the mix. They don't emit greenhouse gas emissions, but as you said, we haven't figured out what to do with the waste, and that's a huge problem. You know, they want to put it in Nevada where environmentally it's not safe. There's too much water in that mountain, damaged air quality. The other solution, which I believe involves one of your compacts, is take the waste from nuclear power plants and put it in a regional site in a dump. I don't believe that's the answer. What I would do is I would take our labs, all these brilliant scientists we have at all our labs here in California and New Mexico and Illinois and say, find a technological solution to dispose of it. Do it. Do it within 5 or 10 years. I mean, we're paying you all this money. Do something. I think the answer is in technology. Now, what I don't agree with, Fernando, is in this last energy bill, they gave all the subsidies to big oil companies, to nuclear, and to coal. I would take those away and have a level playing field. I think the future is in renewable. I think the future is in solar and wind and biomass, in distributed generation and biofuels. I don't believe the future is in nuclear, but am I going to try to stop it? No. Am I going to give it a preference? No. They should compete like everybody else, but as a start, they should take away the preferences that we have. Plus, the public, you know, is not convinced that nuclear power is safe. The nuclear power companies have to come to communities and say, you know, we are safe. This is what we're doing. We're improving. I'm not sure they're willing to do that.
You know, I haven't seen any coverage on this, but I'm not sure how it is that other countries like France that use nuclear power, how do they dispose of their nuclear waste?
Well, I believe what they have is they have big, big regional dumps, which are very unpopular. You know, I can understand who wants a high-level nuclear waste in their backyard. I believe that we need technology to find ways to dispose it. People say, well, how are you going to do that? Well, we're America. We're the nation of innovation. We went to the moon. You know, why can't? I don't mind saying I think big. People always say, you know, you've got big solutions. Yeah, I do. I think this country needs bold, brave, strong solutions that are out of the mainstream. Bipartisan solutions. You know, I don't have all the... My party doesn't have all the answers. You know, you got to get things done. You can't do it with one party. You got to get independents. You got to get Democrats, Republicans. You got to say, hey, let's put these three issues aside. If I'm president, let's deal with these three issues on a bipartisan basis. One, how to get out of Iraq in a sensible way. Two, the deficit. You can only resolve that in a bipartisan way. Three, what are we going to do with Social Security and Medicare? I mean, look, in the outer years, the safety net is a little exposed. How can we deal with these issues in a way? And then the rest of them, you know, you want to duke it out on education and Guantanamo, although I'd get rid of that too, is different.
Here's a question from the audience. Some of our deficit comes from a huge trade imbalance in which we spend much more in buying imports from foreign countries, especially China and Japan, than what foreign countries spend in buying exports from us. What needs to change?
Well, what needs to change, we got to stop giving tax incentives to companies that move overseas. That would be a good start. But I also, you know, this is globalization. Doesn't mean it's good. I believe globalization has kind of left our middle class and a lot of poor people out, and that has to be redressed. Basically, when it comes to trade, I'm a free trader. I voted for NAFTA. I kind of wish I'd insisted more that there be stronger labor and environmental standards. There were, but there weren't. I also thought that NAFTA would reduce immigration at the border. It didn't. So I'm disappointed with the way we've had trade agreements. What I would do to improve our trade imbalance is, one, you promote American exports. Two, I believe there's a tremendous potential of technology and sales. Our technology and renewable energy, especially with China, clean energy. But what I would do, Fernando, with any new trade agreement is I would say, America's not going to have any more trade agreements that are free. They're going to be called fair. And they have to abide by the following standards. And I've changed a little bit. I'm not apologizing for my vote on NAFTA. I think it was the right one because I think protectionism doesn't work. Because that's sort of saying, okay, we're losing and we're going to slap a tariff on another product. I believe our tariffs are the best. I would have trade agreements only if they abide by the following standards. One, international labor standards. No slave labor, no child labor, freedom of association, the right to organize, collective bargaining, and ways that you can enhance environmental quality. You know, I thought with NAFTA, I thought we were going to have all these investments at the border to clean it up, air quality. Didn't happen. You know, we got to insist that that happen. Am I answering too long?
No. I'm just, it's thought-provoking. Our military budget has exploded because of Iraq and Afghanistan, and we keep cutting domestic programs. Congress is unwilling to raise taxes to pay for war abroad and peace at home. If we don't raise taxes, how do we fund domestic programs?
I don't believe the solution is always to raise taxes. And you talked about the defense budget. Clearly, the defense budget needs to be scrutinized. One, this war in Iraq, the huge procurement ripoffs that have taken place, the Halliburtons of the world, on no-bid contracts. And there's some, I think there's some weapon systems, and I'm going to be specific, the F-22, the Osprey helicopter, that, you know, this is a new world. We have challenges. It's called international terrorism, nuclear proliferation, and we got to adapt our military budget to do that. That means a lot of weapon systems are outdated. But also, Fernando, I want to tell you, we need more men and women in the Army and in the Marines. We need more special forces. I mean, the president wants to put more troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Where's he going to get them? He gets them from the National Guards. You know, from like, I'm a commander of a National Guard. Our New Mexico guardsmen have been in Iraq and Afghanistan several times. They're at the border helping with immigration. I need them for fires and disasters. So, yes, we need to reduce the defense budget, but at the same time, there are some special needs. I'm not for a military draft, but I want to recruit and retain our military. I want to get an opportunity for our military to know that when they go into harm's way, which I would use as a last resort, at least they have the equipment, the Humvees, the armor, you know, which they don't have today.
Speaking of the military, can you comment on the don't ask, don't tell policy? This is a question from the audience regarding the existence of homosexuality in the armed forces.
Yes. Here's my answer. If I'm president, I'll get rid of don't ask, don't tell. Here's why. You know, and this is going to be controversial. Somebody is gay or lesbian, they're in the military, they're fighting for our country, we shouldn't give them a lecture on their sexual preference. So I'd get rid of that. I also want you to know that I believe that, you know, we've lost a certain number of our standards as an international community and as a country. I'd go in and one of these first few days that I said I would take as president, although I got to take a day off in between all these things we're doing, is I would say, you know, when it comes to gays and lesbians, everybody in America should not be discriminated on the basis of sexual orientation. I've supported civil unions, not marriage, but I believe that protection on insurance, on there should be no hate crimes. I believe that this country has moved far enough, so we should be tolerant. We should not discriminate against anybody. You know, this is why this policy in Guantanamo, it involves, you know, look what we do. We don't have habeas corpus anymore. We detain and don't tell people why they're being detained. You know, they're stuck in that prison there. That Guantanamo represents something that we're no longer, that America, that we've lost. We've lost a sense of our protection, and saying that torture, it's okay to torture if you waterboard, you know, you put somebody's head in the water. This is the vice president saying it's okay to do that. And at the debate, I'm going to get a little partisan, the Republican debate, they all were like, let's increase waterboarding, you know, to get into information. That's not America.
Here's another question from the audience and the plug for one of our sponsors, the San Jose Mercury News. The U.S. spends about 48% of the entire world's defense spending and twice as much as China, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, Japan, and Germany combined. So I take it from Mercury News must be true. How would you propose to significantly reduce this defense budget without succumbing to charges of being soft on terrorism.
I'm going to say something about the San Jose Mercury News, and I'm not sucking up, all right? You know, I think you guys have done a great job of investigative journalism, including investigating some of the things that I did in the Department of Energy when I was there. I think you did a good job. I think a free press is very important. On the defense budget, look, I'm not somebody that says I'm going to shift all the money to domestic needs. No, I believe we have to have a homeland security policy. I don't believe we have it today, where we adequately protect our ports, cargo, inspect suitcases. I believe our airlines, our airports are being better scrutinized. But, you know, I'd say to TSA or Transportation Security, for Christ's sakes, treat the public right, you know, or find ways that do you need to inspect a 85-year-old lady, you know, that just is going to see her daughter? I mean, can't we have a more efficient technological system if people travel continuously and they're scrutinized, that they don't have to go through the same procedure everybody else does? Let's be a little more customer friendly. But I also believe that there are some weapon systems that are outdated. I mentioned them. I would have a nuclear weapons reduction with the Russians. You know, it has to be done by both countries. We've had the last arms control agreement was, you know, in the first days of the Clinton administration. We got to do better. Do we need thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons? Do we need, as the president wants to do, spend $30 billion in developing new nuclear weapons, more modernized? I mean, come on. We got some domestic priorities in this country. And let's be realistic about the threats that we have: international terrorism, al-Qaeda, it's there. Nuclear proliferation, a loose nuclear weapon, you know, with maybe as much liquid as something like this, uranium, plutonium, coming across a border sponsored by a rogue nation or a bandit. Or tribal and ethnic warfare as it exists today in places like Darfur. Why don't we care about Africa? We care about the Middle East. We care about Europe. What about this? There's a genocide in Africa. There's 2 million human beings that have been displaced, 300,000 that have died. And, you know, we just keep talking, and I'm criticized because I said, well, you know, China has the Olympics. I'm not saying you boycott the Olympics, but say to China, hey, you know, you're going to get a national movement saying to you that maybe countries won't attend the Olympics because you're helping the Sudanese government. That's called a little pressure. It's called diplomacy.
I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our guest today is Bill Richardson, governor of New Mexico and 2008 Democratic presidential candidate. Our third and final group of questions deal with foreign policy, defense, intelligence, and national security. President Clinton appointed you as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations in 1997, and you had an opportunity to learn firsthand the major foreign policy issues that we face. I think you know that many Americans distrust the UN and feel that it's not working the way its founders intended. Do you agree with that, or are there any changes you'd like to see in that organization?
I believe the United Nations is a good institution. I believe we should use it more than we have, especially in this last administration. I believe we get international credibility and support when we go to the United Nations when there's a military operation. I believe there are times when you shouldn't use the UN in the Israeli-Palestinian issue. They just basically get in the way because Israel is outnumbered. That doesn't mean that you don't try to bring forth policies that the United Nations, where we share common goals. The UN is very good at dealing with international humanitarian problems. We should use it more. AIDS, refugees, diseases around the world, international poverty issues. I would use it more there. The UN needs to reform itself in terms of its financial proprieties. It's got a lot of problems. There's a lot of, you know, there was a lot of abuse in the Oil for Food program with Iraq, people ripping off the money. That's not right. But I would use, as a president, the UN more constructively because, you know, this is the one place where if there's a crisis, automatically the five major powers meet: Russia, China, the United States, France, and Great Britain. But, you know, we haven't, Fernando, modernized these international institutions like the International Monetary Fund, like the World Bank. You know why Bono is so popular? Because he's saying all of this debt that third world countries accumulate, that's not a way to rebuild nations and developing countries. He's right. The same with the UN. We haven't modernized it. You know, there are five powers that call all the shots. You know, I'm glad that we're one of them. But, you know, what about, I would add countries to the Security Council. What about one from Africa? What about one from Asia? One from Latin America? The world is changing. And it doesn't mean they get veto power, but, you know, who in Latin America? Well, Mexico or Brazil or, you know, somebody, they can come up with a country among themselves. Who in Asia? India, Pakistan? I mean, China's already there. Who in Africa? Well, Nigeria, they're the biggest, South Africa. I mean, we have to expand the representation so there's inclusiveness. And most of the crises the UN handles are in the third world. They're in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, with the exception of Bosnia and other ethnic conflicts we've had in Europe.
The problem hasn't been that we haven't given funding or funds to foreign countries. The problem has been that the money goes to the people at the top and it never gets down to the intended recipients or beneficiaries. How would you change that?
Well, first, I'm going to say something that's unpopular. We need to spend more in our foreign assistance programs because we can't afford not to. Now, I also believe that it has been misdirected, Fernando. There's too much corruption. We don't make sure that it gets to the lower ends. I think our foreign aid should be targeted at nutrition, education programs, renewable energy. Who won the Nobel Prize? A guy named Mohammed Yunus. You know what he did in Bangladesh? His company, called Microlending, would give loans, I think an average, $17 to women to, you know, dress shops. And it started increasing and exploding, and more people had jobs, entrepreneurship. That's the kind of foreign assistance budget I would have. I would also look at the Arab world. I mean, our credibility in the Arab world, I mean, it's pretty shattered. And these are mainly young people, and we have a lot of interest there. I would find ways with a Muslim world to increase education programs, people-to-people programs. Start at the bottom. Also say to our friends like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, stop having anti-American teachings in your elementary schools that we're the bad guys. You got to stop that. You're our friend. That's not the case. But I believe what is so important is a redirection of these foreign policies to deal with debt, to deal with nutrition programs, to deal with the fact that, you know, a large percent of globalization is missing a lot. One out of three people in the world have never used a telephone, much less a cell phone. I mean, what's the world's poverty level? It's maybe 25% of the people in the world are poor. Why are we not preoccupied with rape and sexual slavery and in Africa, nutrition and AIDS? You know, what is it, 20% of Africa has AIDS or the HIV virus? I think it's gone down. Why aren't we leading in that? And I will say something about President Bush. I commend him. He has increased funding for the Millennium Goals that deal with AIDS funding. So I'm going to give him credit there. I just wish the Congress would support that.
Presidents typically have a year or two to launch their most important initiatives. And what are, say, your top two or three initiatives that you would have in foreign policy in that period of time?
Oh, foreign policy?
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned several times, the first day I'd get out of Iraq, but I would do it with diplomacy. I'd have a reconciliation conference, the Sunnis, the Shia, the Kurds, get them in a room and say to them, there's going to be a coalition government. We're going to divide up your country into three entities, not three states. There's going to be a oil revenue that is going to be split up. This is not new. This is what the Maliki government said they would do. So this is not new. But now you have to do it. We'd use the leverage of the withdrawal. I'd have an all-Muslim peacekeeping force. And I would include Iran and Syria. You know what? Yitzhak Rabin, Nobel Prize winning Israeli prime minister who was assassinated. You know what he said, Fernando? He said, you don't make peace with your friends. You make peace with your enemies. That's a fundamental belief that I have. Now, if it doesn't work, obviously you use stronger measures. But you start out with negotiation, with diplomacy, with finding common ground, with, you know, recognizing that all these countries know that America has this huge military power. But you don't use it unless you absolutely have to. And so that's what I would do that first day that I'd be in office. I mentioned, again, global climate change, energy independence, a new redirection in our foreign policy that deals with values, like shutting down Guantanamo and saying, we're now going to rejoin the International Criminal Court. We're now going to find ways to abide by the International Declaration of Human Rights. We're also going to find ways to say to the world that, you know, America's back, that we want to be an economic and political but moral leader as well.
You touched on this briefly, but as president, and I didn't hear you say if you had any military background other than you're on the reserves as a officer in the reserves, are you?
No. No.
Okay. As governor of the reserves.
I'm commander of the National Guard.
That's what threw me. As president, would you impose a timetable for withdrawal of our forces in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and if so, when and under what conditions?
Well, I wouldn't in Afghanistan. I believe our vital interests are involved there. I believe al-Qaeda and the Taliban are dangerous to us, and we have a vested interest, and we have multinational support in Afghanistan. NATO's there. I believe that is a strong mission. In fact, Fernando, I think I would add some of our troops in Afghanistan. In Iraq, this policy has been a disaster. And what I would do is, I would have a fixed withdrawal. If I were president today, I'd get our troops out by the end of this calendar year. And here's the difference between me. Here's the difference between me and the other candidates in my party. I would leave no residual forces. No residual forces. And it's because I think our troops have become targets. I believe that we're viewed as the occupiers. Here are two polls I just want you to think about. 61% of the Iraqi people now think it's okay to shoot at an American soldier. 61. 72% of the Sunnis and Shia want us out within a year. Now, maybe not the government, maybe not the big shots. But I believe that the withdrawal makes sense because only after withdrawal can the hard diplomatic work start. And I'm not saying we get out and say, okay, we're out of there. No. We engage with what is called leadership. Leadership. Get the parties to build a coalition government. Bring an all-Muslim peacekeeping force. Find donor countries to participate in the reconstruction of Iraq. Will my plan work? I believe it can. Can I guarantee it? No. Some say, well, Governor, you know, your plan's going to bring civil war, sectarian conflict. There is civil war. There is sectarian conflict. And so I believe what we need to do is do what's right. And if we get out of this obsession with Iraq, we can concentrate on what really affects our foreign policy. Threats of international terrorism, talking to the North Koreans directly, which we failed to do for years, which I've been able to do. Deal with the Irans. Deal with nuclear proliferation. Deal with so many other priorities and needs that we have as a country. Rebuild our own people so that the American people feel that in their own shores, in their own homes, in their own airports, that you're safe. I'm not sure we can say that. Yeah, we've made some improvements. But there's just so much more to be done with America's role in the world. We've been so obsessed with Iraq that that's what we're known for. I don't want our country to be known for that disaster.
You mentioned dealing with the threat and proliferation of nuclear weapons in Iran and North Korea. Just how do you propose to deal with these folks who often don't want to deal with us?
Well, I've dealt with North Korea. I was there 2.5 months ago. And our objective was to try to get the remains of our, six remains of our Korean war veterans that were there that died. We got them back. That was important. The second objective was to try to get them to agree that we should have a, that they should abide by an agreement they made with six countries, including the U.S., that they get rid of their nuclear weapons and invite inspectors in. They haven't still done this, but we have tried, and I believe this is how you deal with North Korea. And then if there's time, you want me to talk about Iran?
Sure, sure.
All right. Well, with North Korea, this is the deal with North Korea, and I believe it's been laid out. It's not something that I necessarily have thought of myself, but it's been laid out by this administration and others, and this is the way it goes. North Korea, you get rid of your nuclear weapons. You let international inspectors in, but you get rid of all of them within a certain period of time. In exchange, this is what we, the six-party countries, give you. One, we promise we won't attack you. You know, that's important to the North Koreans. Number two, in other words, an armistice agreement that ends the Korean War. Number two, you get food. This is the poorest nation on earth. I mean, they're isolated, they're desperate, they're unpredictable. They live in the 50s, but their people are starving, they're hurting. We should find ways, energy assistance, food, fuel, not just the U.S., I'm talking about South Korea, Japan, China, everybody chips in. That's how I believe you deal with North Korea. Is it going to be difficult? Yeah. But what have we been doing? I mean, we've been isolating them. You know, they shoot these missiles. They explode nuclear weapons. They may have five or six. You don't want them to have that. It's not good for anybody. We got 37,000 American troops on the border. Why contribute to tension? With Iran, you know, this is tough. But what we need, I believe, is a realistic policy with Iran. For one, I wouldn't announce publicly that we've got military options against them. That doesn't strike me as them feeling that they want to deal with us. Secondly, they're tough, and they've got a leader there who is very unpredictable and irrational. So what would I do? I would talk to students. I would talk to the 40% of Iranians that have voted for progressive candidates. Now, when it comes to negotiation, we can't have them have a nuclear weapon. I mean, it's against our interests, Israel, the community, but maybe they're 4 years away. So what you do, if you're going to have a negotiating leverage, Iran is susceptible to, I believe, economic sanctions, not military sanctions. They import one half of their gasoline. They only have one oil refinery. They import half of their commodities. There's domestic unrest. But in order to have economic sanctions with Iran, you have to have cooperation from Russia, from the Security Council at the UN, who don't want to do it because we have failed to persuade them or they don't like us. And so Iran kind of thumbs their nose at us. And they've arrested five or six Iranian Americans on very spurious charges. But I would be finding ways to deal with them, seek common ground. Doesn't mean you cave in. You can deliver a very tough message when you're dealing directly. But we don't talk to them directly. And believe me, I believe that bringing Iran in can help us resolve the issue of Iraq. Nobody wants in their borders turmoil. Nobody wants thousands of refugees coming in. Saudi Arabia, Iran, they don't want Iraq to blow up. And so I believe it makes sense to try to find common ground and negotiate. We started doing that a little bit. We started talking to Syria. I mean, how are we going to help Israel? I'm a big believer in the state of Israel. Now, is Israel today safer? No. They got Hezbollah on one side, Hamas. You got Iran wanting to build nuclear weapons. Just believe the key to all this, if there's one message I want to leave with you, what I'm about diplomacy. I'm about bringing people together. I'm about seeking common ground. I'm not about, you know, making threats and we're going to, you know, have a bomb strike. Yeah, that always has to be an option for American president to protect the American people. But I believe there are better ways to achieve our goals.
Thank you. Let's bring this back a little bit to the domestic for a minute. Here's a question from the audience. What would be the federal arts and culture policy in your administration, given that we've seen a consistent deterioration in support by the federal government in those areas?
You know, Fernando, I'll answer that, but there's one issue that we never talk about. We've had several debates, and we never talk about education, and I think we've probably run out of time. We should always recognize that our schools, our teachers are critically important if we're going to be competitive in all these areas, healthcare, international trade, bringing families together. I won't go into it unless you want me to, but the arts. You know, this relates to my answer on schools. We are, right now, our high school curriculums are not keeping up. They need to be revised. They need to be revised, I believe, in four areas, and I've added a fifth, and it's called the arts. Okay. Science and math. You know, we're 28th in the world in science and math scores after high school. China, India, European Union are beating us. That's competitiveness. That's not like, you know, not people don't like science and math. That's competitiveness. That's the future. One out of two minority kids don't graduate from high school. You know, our educational system. And what I believe is also needed in curriculums, and I'm talking about a national curriculum, and I'm not necessarily saying you take away the state's role in education or local, but having the state be, the federal government be partners. Here are the two other areas, civics, science, math, civics, languages, and the arts. Now, you know, I'm big on New Mexico, Santa Fe. We have more art galleries than houses. You know, so we're big in promoting the arts and local communities. But I think, Fernando, what I would be for is a massive federal role to help local schools and communities with arts education. I believe that through the arts, through music, through drama, through giving kids an opportunity to be creative, you do that early. You have preschool. You have full-day kindergarten. You bring the arts early. That will be an enormous breadth of experience that allow our kids to be stronger when it comes to science and math. So I would not only, yes, fund the National Endowment of the Arts, the humanities, I think those have been underfunded, but I would have a national art and schools program, and it would be a budget issue, and I would invest in that. We got to invest in kids. If you have education, that will unlock a lot of these problems, but you can't start it like in college. You got to start in preschool. This is why I would have a national preschool under four. You get the kids before they're four. You get the kids in full-day kindergarten. There's so many things that we need to do that we can do.
Well, we've reached that point in our program where we have time for one last question. I think you're going to like it. Do you have a local organization or website to support your presidential campaign?
Well, I do.
That's from the audience, by the way.
I do. It's called www.richardsonforpresident.com.
How'd you come up with that?
You know, through technology, we're investing a lot in technology and blogging and internet. I'm very pleased that 20% of our donations have come online, which shows there's support out there. And the only message, is this concluding?
Yeah.
All right. The only request I have for all of you is this. You got a lot of good candidates out there. And I just hope that a decision is made, not on the basis of who's the biggest rock star, or who has the most celebrity, or who has the most money. I just hope that those of us that maybe started late, that have different visions, or from different regions of the country. I'm from the West. I'm the only Western candidate, governor. That we have a chance. And you're a huge state. And you know, when the voting comes on February 5th, I'm not going to have the television that other candidates have, because I'm going to be concentrating on the first four states. I'm going to travel a lot here. I don't just come into California with one big rally and leave. I've been here 3 days. I mean, I'm leaving tonight for Las Vegas, Nevada, which is the second primary. And I just hope that you give us a chance. I think these forums, Fernando, are excellent. I hope every candidate participates. I mean, this is the oldest club that has these issues.
Our thanks to Bill Richardson, governor of New Mexico in 2008, Democratic presidential candidate. We also thank our audience here in San Jose and those of you joining us on the radio. Today's program has been co-organized by the Mexican Heritage Plaza of San Jose with the Commonwealth Club of California and presented in association with ABC Television Channel 7, KGO News Talk Radio AM 810, and the Bay Area News Group, including the San Jose Mercury News. I'm Fernando Sasueta. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you and good day.